your online community for positive change. Seventh Wave Network.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know by.
Welcome to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education, with your hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis. This program will give parents and educators the skills and methods to effectively advocate for children today. And now, here's Rich and Michelle.
Welcome to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education. I'm Michelle Davis, and Rich Weinfeld, my co-host, is not with us today. Instead, we have a guest co-host, Dr. Jean Painter, who I'll be introducing in just a minute. Our show, Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education, is committed to extraordinary education for all students. Rich and I believe that with high expectation and an education system that works, all children can learn. This show is for parents, this show is for students, this show is for educators, and we look forward to continuing to bring you hot topics in education. Just a preview of our next week's show on June the 6th, we're very excited to have Chancellor Michelle Rhee, who is the Chancellor of Education of the District of Columbia Public Schools, and this is one of the most challenged school districts in our nation, and Chancellor Rhee has the hard and challenging task of revamping that school system. So we're very excited. We hope that you will tune in. Our show is a call-in and an email-in show. If you'd like to email our guest today and any time during the week, our email address is specialneedsadvocacy@msn.com. The call-in number for questions or comments, 1-866-472-5792. Today we're going to be talking about giftedness, gifts and talents and children with these gifts and talents and the importance of gifted education and exploring talents within our youth. And I have with me today my guest co-host, Dr. Jean Painter. And Jean is the state specialist for gifted and talented education in Maryland. She is, therefore, the gifted education director for the entire state. And she is committed to extraordinary advocacy for students with all types of special needs, but especially students who are gifted and have special needs in that arena. I was very privileged to be able to work with Jean. She wrote the last chapter of our Special Needs Advocacy Resource Book, What You Can Do Now to Advocate for Your Exceptional Child's Education. And her chapter is about how parents can band together and form advocacy groups on behalf of children. Jean, thank you for your work with children, your work in the area of gifted education, and thank you especially for co-hosting today. We're so glad to have you on air with us.
Oh, Michelle, this is great. It's really a pleasure to be here.
So the first thing that we do, before we introduce our guest, who is Dr. Jean Van Tassel Basca, Joyce Van Tassel Basca, who is an extraordinary gifted educator, we do a Hot Topics in Education, a news roundup, if you will. And Jean, I think you have an interesting article out of the LA Times to share with us.
Yes, it's really interesting, Michelle, that gifted education and gifted children, these topics are in the news more than ever. And I've looked at several articles in the past couple weeks, and I'm seeing a theme, gifted students getting left out and gifted students losing out. So the first article that I noticed from a couple weeks ago in the LA Times, are gifted students getting left out? And what I see in this article is a profile of a gifted student, Dalton Sargent, and he's 15. He's a high school student in Altadena, California, and he is gifted, but he also is a great profile for dispelling the myths that people have about gifted students. First of all, Dalton doesn't get the best grades in his class. That's a myth. Gifted students don't always get the best grades if they're not challenged or appropriately placed. Dalton's not a teacher pleaser. He definitely does sort of walk to the beat of his own drum. And so he shows us an important characteristic of gifted kids that we need to be looking out for. The article makes the point that gifted kids don't succeed on their own no matter what, that they do need special programs. And when Dalton doesn't get those programs, he really doesn't do that well in school. Dalton goes to a school where we sometimes think gifted kids don't exist. And that's another stereotype, that students in poor, low-achieving schools aren't gifted, that the gifted programs are in the upper middle class, suburban schools. But the kids that lose out the most when they don't have gifted programs are kids like Dalton in the school which he attends. So that's another stereotype.
Dean, that's so fascinating, the myths and stereotypes that we have about kids who are gifted and talented. I'm looking at the Education's Wag the Dog, Geniuses Lost article from EdWeek, and this is an article by Dick Kantenberger. And in the article, he's very concerned about the exact things, concerns that this article that you just shared brought up. He's asking the question, why are we losing potential leaders? And he's saying that he believes that most Americans think that because kids are very intelligent that they just don't need any help. You know, it's kind of an attitude of if they're that smart that they'll work it out and they'll be okay. And he makes the point that these kids are just as vulnerable as the academically challenged students and students with special needs. Is that kind of what you're saying also with this article?
Absolutely, absolutely. These students have a unique potential. They actually think and learn differently, but they still need education and training just like any other child. And they just need it done a little differently. And in that article, another point that I thought was really important is that the teachers of these students need special training. Most teachers without training don't recognize gifted kids, and especially gifted kids in disadvantaged areas where the kids aren't challenged and their gifts may not even show themselves. Another point that he makes is that gifted kids are going to do something. And if they're not given respectful work, work that challenges them, they're going to find something else to do. They're too smart to do nothing. So we need to channel this incredible potential. We just can't afford to lose it.
That's an absolutely great point. You know, in the same article, it's talking about what does a typical gifted and talented class look like? And, you know, it's often a mix of Asian and white middle-class boys with a smattering of girls, Hispanics, and African-Americans. And he also expresses some concern or almost outrage that the groups that advocate for those populations are not beating down the doors to try to have their children, quote, found for the gifted and talented education programs in the nation.
Absolutely. He says, where are the civil rights leaders? Where are the advocates for the poor? Why aren't they speaking up for the gifted students in their population? And these are students that in today's world don't really want to be found. They're going to hide their gifts. They're not going to fit in. And one of the best advocates they can have is the teachers in the classroom. But as I said before, without training, teachers don't know what to look for. And I know in my own state of Maryland right now, unfortunately, we don't require any special training for teachers of gifted students.
I am aware, though, in some other states, such as Florida, that has a very well-developed gifted education system, that actually there are some states that have special plans dedicated to students who are gifted and talented and who have been identified, and different teacher certifications.
Yes, fortunately, you're right. About half, little less than half of our states do have some kind of teacher certification. And we'll talk later to Joyce Van Tasselbask about her own state and her own teacher education program, which is really state of the art. But we need people to speak up. We need legislators. State legislators really don't know anything about gifted kids and their plight. And those are the folks that typically will vote on funds. And I think it's really important that, and that plea is also made at the end of this article, Wag the Dog article, that we need to let them know, parents, educators, those of us who are aware, we've got to educate, and we've got to educate the public.
Well, they've got some some organizations. For example, Council for Exceptional Children has an actual association for the gifted, and then, of course, we have the National Association for Gifted Education, the NAGC, and these are organizations that are dedicated to this. Jean, before we go to our first break, why don't you introduce our guest today who's going to help us to explore all of these topics and even more, including the non-negotiables of a gifted education classroom?
I'd love to. I don't know how I would do my work without the work that she has done. Dr. Joyce Van Tasselbaska is the Jody and Leighton Smith Professor of Education at the College of William & Mary, where she is also the Executive Director of the Center for Gifted Education. If any of you are listening, work in gifted education, Joyce has had almost every role there is, from classroom teacher, English teacher, to local school system coordinator, state director, and most recently president of the National Association for Gifted Children. She's published 20 books, 345 articles and chapters, but for me, Joyce is best known for leading 20 years of research and curriculum development at the Center for Gifted Education.
We are so pleased to have her, and we'll be talking with her straight after we come back from break. Stay tuned and send us emails and phone calls for Dr. Joyce Van Tasselbaska.
You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Are you paying too much for term life insurance? There's a price war among the major term life carriers. Consider these possible rates. A man age 45, non-tobacco user, could obtain $1 million of coverage for as little as $75 a month, and this rate is fixed for the next 10 years. We specialize in policies of $500,000 and above. A man age 50, non-tobacco user, may be able to obtain $500,000 of coverage for as little as $115 per month, and this rate is fixed for the next 20 years. That's right, guaranteed not to change for 20 years. We have great rates for smokers too. For new or replacement term life insurance, call the Term Lifeline now. 800-890-5075. 800-890-5075. That's 800-890-5075.
How can we be powerful advocates for the children in our lives? How do we ensure that they're getting the best education possible? The Special Needs Advocacy Training Institute prepares parents and educators to be outstanding advocates for school success. The Training Institute is based on Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis's Special Needs Advocacy Resource Book. The book is comprehensive, practical, and easy to read. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn more about this dynamic training opportunity. Parents, are you concerned with your child's progress at school? Educators educators. Do you wish that you could do more for your class? Are you interested in pursuing a career in educational advocacy? At SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com, you'll learn how to make a difference in the lives of children. You will also find information about Rich and Michelle's consulting and advocacy services. Our children need powerful advocates to ensure that they're getting an appropriate education. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn what you can do to more effectively advocate for the children in your life.
A fresh look at today's health. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Teach your children well.
You're listening to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education with hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or tip regarding today's topic, give us a call toll-free at 866-472-5792. That number again is 866-472-5792. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education. I'm Michelle Davis, and our usual co-host, Rich Weinfeld, is not with us today. We have a superb guest co-host, Dr. Jean Painter, and before the break, Jean, you introduced to us Joyce, Dr. Joyce Van Tassel-Baska, our guest today. And Jean, I think that you can go ahead and start out and ask Joyce the nature of giftedness and start us off in our conversation today.
Certainly. It's really a privilege to have Joyce with us today. And Joyce, I guess my first question is the question most people wonder about. What exactly does it mean to be gifted? How are these students different from other children?
Okay, that's a big question, Jean, and I'm very happy to be on the show, by the way, and thank you for asking me to join you. Let me begin by just suggesting a very simple definition for the notion of who's gifted, and that is students who show advanced behaviors in one domain or in multiple domains are certainly candidates to look more closely at relative to their potential giftedness. And when I say advanced development in young children, that would be early reading behavior or early mathematics interest and fascination with numbers. I can think of a 3-year-old who came to our center who was already memorizing all of the street addresses in his entire neighborhood, which constituted, you know, multiple blocks. And his parents told me that when they went on vacation, he memorized all the license plates they passed on the road trip to and from the vacation spot. And then students who really love to take things apart and put them back together again, like to know how the world works. That's that sort of nonverbal, you know, giftedness. So there's lots of different areas that giftedness can manifest itself in, whether it's verbal, mathematical, or, you know, more scientific in orientation, if you think about traditional subject matter areas in schools. Or it can also be in creative areas, the arts, leadership. All of those are domains in which, again, students can show advanced development in comparison to students who are exactly the same age as they are.
So I'm really glad that you expanded the, you know, and it's not just reading, writing, arithmetic that we can be gifted in and show different talents in. Does, you know, we may have all heard about multiple intelligences, and a couple that maybe I thought of when you were listing those is the musical area,
mm-hmm.
and also I think that one was added, the naturist or the outdoors, you know, nature lover. Are those two areas that people can also show gifts and talents?
I would say that any area or discipline or domain in which we have, you know, organized knowledge could be an area in which, you know, individuals could show precocity. And by precocity, I just mean advanced development in relationship to age peers. That's really been our best indicator of thinking about who might be gifted. But there's another piece to it as well that I haven't alluded to, and that is that these students not only may be ahead of their age peers because of exposure or interest or predispositions to want to, you know, get into certain areas of learning as opposed to others, but they also have the capacity to think more complexly about their world, think more complexly about what it is they're studying, and therefore are able to use higher level thinking in multiple ways and in multiple types in terms of applying it to their learning. Those are probably the two best researched differences that we know about gifted children, the issue of their precocity and the issue of the complexity of their thought processes.
You know, Joyce, I talk to a lot of parents in my work, as do you, and we have the myth of the GT parent, that your child is advanced because you have sort of, you know, programmed them to be advanced, that every parent thinks his child is gifted. And that really isn't true. You can't teach a child to do the things that you just mentioned this three-year-old is doing.
Right.
That three-year-old is different.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, a couple of things are, you know, maybe important to acknowledge here. You know, one is that giftedness is not a static concept. It's a developmental concept. And it's an interactive concept between the genetic potential of any given child and the environmental stimulation that that child receives over, you know, the span of years where, you know, the brain is most malleable in terms of development, which
does
would
that,
be right up through adolescence, obviously.
Does but, that actually mean that gifted, that a child can be possibly gifted during one part of his life and maybe not another?
Well, it's certainly very possible if, in fact, there hasn't been strong environmental stimulation provided at key stages of development along the way. You could have a child who, in fact, could have, you know, very good potential for giftedness, but because it's not been developed and nurtured, we would never know because we'll never see what that child is capable of doing. By the same token, you could have, as Jean was mentioning, a very zealous parent who may have a child who's, you know, quite typical in terms of behaviors at the age level, but really wants them to do, you know, much more than what they're doing. And so provides a very stimulating home environment, insists on the best kinds of options in terms of school, and depending on the child's personality and their motivation and a whole lot of other factors, that child still is likely to do much better as a result of this external stimulation than not, even though I would argue that the model that I like to think about in terms of the individual potential is sort of like we all have a rubber band in terms of thinking about how much we're capable of growing and developing as far as intellectual ability is concerned. And so we know that it's malleable, but it's not without limits. And just as a rubber band has an upper limit, so too, in terms of what one can do with any child at any given stage of development, there is probably an upper limit relative to what they're capable of handling. But again, in terms of what we know about most educational settings, we don't begin to tap into the capacity of students, particularly those who are already advanced, into what they're capable of doing. So I think the rubber band theory maybe holds up and does discount a bit the notion that you can make any child gifted.
You know, Jean talked about the article that highlighted some myths and stereotypes of students who are gifted. How will we find these students if the right set of factors are not in place? You know, what if there's a child who is truly gifted in the area of music but never picks up an instrument?
Mm-hmm.
How will we find those geniuses in our society, or will they not be found possibly?
They probably will not be found because we know, again, from genetic research that there's a strong interaction effect between genetic potential and environmental conditions. So if the environmental conditions are not there to develop certain kinds of talents, they are not likely to, you know, become manifest. That, it seems to me, is a, you know, a very basic understanding. That's why we do so much work, or we try to, with schools to provide teachers with the skills to bring out abilities and talents in students so that they really can see who has the strongest potential at particular stages of development. One of the favorite models of our programming at kindergarten, first, and second grade is not to formally identify students as much as trying to observe them in classrooms when we provide very challenging kinds of activities to them in all of the major academic areas and in some instances in terms of project-based learning as well. And it's out of that challenging educational environment that, again, their abilities are likely to emerge.
You know, I talk to a lot of parents who want that challenging environment for their students, and they're frustrated because they really don't know how to go about negotiating the system, talking to teachers, talking to schools. They're very much not the stereotype. They don't want to make waves. They're slightly embarrassed to have to walk into a school and say, you know, my child's bored. First of all, I tell them never to go into the school and say, my child's bored, but to phrase it in a different way and ask the teacher, what is your perception of my child? But they realize that they're going down a long road here where they're going to have to advocate for that proper environment. So I was just wondering, if you were talking to parents, what should parents be advocating for? What should they be looking for in educational settings?
Okay. Well, let me preface my remarks by suggesting that I try to let parents know that it is probably more effective in terms of making the case to schools to have more than one of them coming in and saying, we really think that our child needs greater challenge than he or she is getting, and has some very specific examples of subject areas or classrooms in which the child is not challenged. Because I think the more that the parent can be specific, and the more that, again, there can be two or three or four parents that band together, as it were, probably the more they're likely to be listened to in terms of getting some action. So, you know, I think that's an issue. The second issue is, is this a conversation that should take place only at the teacher level? And given that we know that we have a patchwork quilt of teacher training across the country, as Jean alluded to earlier, it's very difficult to necessarily assume that any given classroom teacher is going to be at all receptive to a parent who is suggesting greater challenge, nor will the teacher necessarily know what to do with that request unless, again, the specifics are, you know, attached to it. So I often recommend to parents as well to not only talk to the teacher, but talk to the principal, talk to the district coordinator of gifted programs, so that, you know, the parent becomes better informed about how the gifted program functions in that school district and what are the relative chances of getting certain kinds of opportunities, you know, for that particular child. So that's kind of a systemic look at parent advocacy that's probably important.
Grace and Jean, we're going to pick up the more conversation about giftedness when we come back from break with our special guest, Dr. Joyce Van Tassel-Baska. Come right back and stay tuned.
Your life, your health, your network. Voice America Health and Wellness.
How can we be powerful advocates for the children in our lives? How do we ensure that they're getting the best education possible? The Special Needs Advocacy Training Institute prepares parents and educators to be outstanding advocates for school success. The Training Institute is based on Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis's Special Needs Advocacy Resource Book. The book is comprehensive, practical, and easy to read. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn more about this dynamic training opportunity. Parents, are you concerned with your child's progress at school? Do you wish that you could do more for your class? Are you interested in pursuing a career in educational advocacy? At SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com, you'll learn how to make a difference in the lives of children. You will also find information about Rich and Michelle's consulting and advocacy services. Our children need powerful advocates to ensure that they're getting an appropriate education. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn what you can do to more effectively advocate for the children in your life.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared. It's like tiny nails in the air poke my lungs. I start to cough.
Did you know your child's asthma attacks can be triggered by things like shower curtains, a blanket, even a teddy bear?
I feel like I'm choking.
And there are many other things in your home and your child's classroom you may not know about. For the latest information, call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS.
Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
Help prevent your child's asthma attacks and avoid the emergency room. Call toll-free 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. That's 1-866-662-8822. Or visit www.noattacks.org.
I don't want to feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Children well. You're listening to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education with hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or tip regarding today's topic, give us a call toll-free at 866-472-5792. That number again is 866-472-5792. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education. I'm Michelle Davis, and here with our guest co-host, Dr. Jean Painter, and our special guest, Dr. Joyce Ventassel-Baska. And we're talking about gifts and talents today, gifted education. And Jean, I think that you were going ahead and talking with Joyce, but I wanted to remind our listeners, please email us or call in. We'd love to hear from parents, children, educators, or anyone regarding our topic today, which is gifted education. Our email address is specialneedsadvocacy@msn.com. The call-in number for questions or comments, 1-866-472-5792.
Jean? Joyce, before the break, you were talking about what parents should advocate for, and I like your point that yeah, it's great to talk to the classroom teacher, but gifted education certainly is a systemic issue. It needs to be a mission of the school and the school system. But in that mission, what are the non-negotiables? What are the essence of gifted education that we should want to provide for our children?
Well, that's a big question too, Jean, but I'll give it a try. I'd probably start with the A word, the need to ensure that school districts and schools offer different forms of acceleration for
gifted learning.
That's the A word, huh? Yeah, acceleration, which really means flexibility in placement in terms of where that child happens to be functioning in a given subject area, so you could have content acceleration, or if the child is very strong across all subject areas and advanced by at least 2 years, you might consider grade acceleration. Or a student who, let's say, at the secondary level has outstripped the curriculum, you might consider dual enrollment, taking a class at a local university, or having a university mentor work with that student. Those are all forms of acceleration, as are our two probably best known and well-received secondary programs, Advanced Placement and International Baccalaureate. Both programs are calibrated to first-year university work, even though students, gifted students, start them as early as 9th or 10th or 11th grade in the context of school. And the point being here is that these are all very legitimate forms of opportunities for gifted learners, and parents just want to be sure that they're in a school and in a school district that recognizes the importance of the allowance of employing acceleration as a part of the overall program.
Joyce, I know that you have more to go on the non-negotiables, but you know what you're making me think of is all the times that I've observed students in a classroom where the curriculum that you developed, the William and Mary curriculum, is in play, and of course I work with students mostly who have special needs, and the students who are accessing that curriculum are kids who are 2E, twice exceptional,
right,
highly gifted, and also with special needs. So
mm-hmm.
It's just an amazing curriculum, and there's a lot of flexibility for differentiation and different types of learning.
Right, but that curriculum is also a content-accelerated curriculum. I believe that you're probably using predominantly the language arts curriculum, where the readings are calibrated to be two grade levels above the norm.
That's
in
right.
terms of grade placement. So the acceleration piece is already built into that curriculum package.
I just want to reiterate the point about acceleration, that the characteristic of how gifted students learn differently, the number one characteristic is they learn faster. They're advanced. So I'm surprised when I hear a lot of resistance, actually, in public schools for acceleration. And I think now more than ever there's that resistance because every student takes a grade level test.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is very unfortunate because there's probably no strategy that has been subjected to continued research over the last 80 years that consistently has shown positive effects, as have studies on acceleration. And particularly for gifted learners, it is a very positive kind of outcome, not just in terms of achievement gains, but also in motivational impact, the opportunity to go on and do more in terms of learning as a result of being accelerated. So there's just lots of benefits that accrue from it, and no downside as far as we can tell from, you know, the research literature that we have available. I also would say that from the standpoint of school district people, it's a very cost-effective program, very cost-effective way to meet the needs of gifted and talented learners if it's used consistently across grade levels.
So you've mentioned the acceleration as a non-negotiable. What
right.
are some other non-negotiables?
Okay, a second one, again, which is also fraught to some degree with controversy, is the issue of grouping gifted learners together, and particularly grouping them to be sure that there's opportunities for peer interaction. What we've found from our studies on our curriculum, and other people have found similar things, is that the grouping model doesn't matter so much as the fact that these students do have an opportunity to be with others like themselves who have similar interests, similar abilities, working, you know, together, you know, many times in collaborative learning situations or in discussion groups, that really aids their growth. So this notion of at least some part of every day gifted students having the opportunity to be with others, you know, in terms of their intellectual peer group, is an important consideration that parents need to think about. Many people in our field for a long period of time have suggested that, you know, if you're a parent of a gifted child, you should always ensure that your child has a playmate who is of similar interest and ability, even if you had to import them from across town. So that notion, even, you know, at very young ages, is a very powerful part of helping gifted students learn. Not only learn cognitively, but also learn about themselves. Learn that they may not be the smartest child in the room or the smartest child in the school. Learn that there are, you know, students who are much better than they are in terms of maybe their learning pattern or maybe the area of learning in which they are engaged. So if we want to reduce the perception that gifted students are elitist in some way or have elitist attitudes, the best way to do away with that is to actually do some peer interaction where they have the opportunity to have a more realistic sense of self.
You know, Joyce, I see this to be the same issue. You know, are we as educating students with special needs, you know, on the other
yes.
end of the continuum, you know, do we have a categorical, meaning segregated, separated classroom or school for those kids? Or do we have a non-categorical kind of heterogeneous grouping model? And I'm really glad you spoke about that.
Mm-hmm. And I would argue that it's not a dichotomous issue either, that fundamentally we ought to have a continuum of service delivery options, just as you do in special education, for different kinds of needs. And even though inclusion classrooms are more common than not, relative to special education, I do know certainly that in many areas, learning disability specialists still prefer to have some of that group time with kids who have learning disabilities, for example, that's a very important part of ensuring that they're well served.
Grouping certainly is controversial, Joyce, and still in public school systems, it's
it's resisted, although I am seeing some changes simply because the research shows that grouping students together with like needs at least part of the time positively impacts their achievement, whether it's a struggling student or a gifted student. And I think the key there is at least part of the time.
Right. I would agree with you.
Yeah.
So we've got the acceleration, we've got the grouping, and we probably have time for one more discussion about another non-negotiable, and then we'll take a break and pick back right up there for the last segment.
Okay. Well, you know, obviously I would not be who I am if I didn't mention the importance of differentiated curriculum and instructional approaches for use with these learners. I do think, as was alluded to earlier, that it isn't just a matter of accelerating courses for these students or moving them up a grade. Once they, in fact, are accelerated, they then need a very powerful learning curriculum that, again, focuses on these higher-level skills of problem-solving, of thinking, of engaging them in research processes, and doing so through active learning approaches and inquiry-based learning approaches, like problem-based learning, like the use of good, you know, questioning techniques by a teacher to ensure that students are thinking in different kinds of ways about a subject. So that element of curriculum and instruction is also crucial. And parents need to be very aware of what the curriculum is in the school and the extent to which the curriculum for the gifted certainly meets the standards that are required but goes beyond those standards in important kinds of ways.
I'd like to remind our listeners that the podcasts of our shows are available on, of course, voiceamerica.com, but also at www.specialneedsadvocacyinstitute.com, which is mine and Rich's shared website. And we had the pleasure of having Dr. Carol Ann Tomlinson on, talking a lot about differentiated instruction. And I'm really glad to hear that the research is bearing out in the world of gifted and talented education as well. Jean, did you want to take us? We have about another minute until our next break.
Well, I'm going to pose a question that we may or may not get to before the break, but this powerful curriculum, Joyce, that you've been instrumental in developing at William & Mary, the problem-based learning, the higher-level questioning, these are things that really address the gifted students' need for complexity.
Mm-hmm.
After the break.
Helping you make informed decisions for your life. This is Voice America Health and Wellness.
Life can be full of risks. One thing you shouldn't take a risk with ever is your family's health insurance. If you're self-employed or an individual and you need affordable health insurance, you need to make this free call right now and see how the Mega Life and Health Insurance Company can help you get it. We specialize in helping the self-employed and individuals just like you who need affordable health insurance to get it. So call us right now. 888-459-4825. 888-459-4825. 459-4825. Don't take a risk with your family's health insurance. It's not worth it. If you're self-employed or an individual and you need affordable health insurance, call us now and see how we can help you. 888-459-4825. 888-459-4825. 888-459-4825. Home office, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Not available in all states. Benefits may vary by state.
How can we be powerful advocates for the children in our lives? How do we ensure that they're getting the best education possible? The Special Needs Advocacy Training Institute prepares parents and educators to be outstanding advocates for school success. The Training Institute is based on Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis's Special Needs Advocacy Resource Book. The book is comprehensive, practical, and easy to read. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn more about this dynamic training opportunity. Parents, are you concerned with your child's progress at school? Educators, do you wish that you could do more for your class? Are you interested in pursuing a career in educational advocacy? At SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com, you'll learn how to make a difference in the lives of children. You will also find information about Rich and Michelle's consulting and advocacy services. Our children need powerful advocates to ensure that they're getting an appropriate education. Visit SpecialNeedsAdvocacyInstitute.com to learn what you can do to more effectively advocate for the children in your life.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Teach your children well.
You're listening to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education with hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or tip regarding today's topic, give us a call toll-free at 866-472-5792. That number again is 866-472-5792. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education, and I'm Michelle Davis here with my co-host today, Dr. Jean Painter, and we're here with Dr. Joyce Van Tassel-Baska. Joyce, I think you were talking about the non-negotiables for gifted education, and we're in our last segment now, and we've very much enjoyed the conversation so far. What's your next non-negotiable in terms of gifted education and what we should be looking for in a gifted classroom?
Well, I think that it's extremely important. We were just talking about differentiation, that in order for differentiation to actually occur in classrooms, not only do teachers need to have effective curriculum, research-based curriculum like the Wayman Mary units, but they also need really strong preparation. And the two national organizations that you alluded to earlier, National Association of Gifted Children and the Council for Exceptional Children, have consensually come together and created a set of standards which have now passed and are now the teacher education standards for the United States. Mm-hmm. And even though in some states there is no endorsement or certification for gifted, what we're trying to do is to use these standards as a wedge, as it were, to move the agenda of being sure that we have teachers who are fully qualified working with gifted learners in all classrooms in the country.
And I think the standards have had an impact, Joyce. I know in my own state they have, of really codifying this is a distinct pedagogy. This is a special body of knowledge that teachers need to know to meet the needs of these kids, and it's just helped to raise awareness. And those standards can also be used just to plan professional development of any kind.
Absolutely. And so it's both a matter of being sure that teachers are well-trained in terms of, you know, multiple competencies that they need to have, but also that schools are constantly working to provide professional development opportunities that will make their staffs, again, much more effective with this population. You know, I also will say, as kind of a spin-off from talking about the standards, one of the things that we're proudest about in terms of these standards is that out of 77 indicators that underlie the 10 standards, fully 37 of them speak to the need to address diversity in terms of the student population and how we respond to the diverse needs of students in gifted programs. And I think that's a major breakthrough for us as a field. Even though we've worked on issues of diversity for a long time, we've not really codified it quite so sharply as we have now in these new teacher education standards.
I'm so glad you brought up the issue of diversity. It's one of my biggest hot topics. You know, there, a couple of things are happening in terms of what I observe on a daily basis in school systems. Sometimes you have, you know, the alleged gifted classrooms are really a bunch of just kind of typical high-functioning kids whose parents have advocated for them to be in a certain classroom, and kids of color and kids from diverse populations are generally not seen in those classrooms, in addition to the advanced placement or even IB international baccalaureate programs, around the entire world.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about why that's happening and what we can do to change it, and if there's a non-negotiable that we should be looking for within that?
Well, the non-negotiable here is very much, again, embedded in the standards, because the standards are all research-based in orientation. But the non-negotiable is ensuring that schools and school districts are proactively working to find and serve underrepresented groups, including students of poverty, students who are culturally diverse, and students who are twice exceptional, that those categories of learners are frequently overlooked for inclusion in gifted programs, and so we need to do a much better job of trying to find them. What we've found in the last several years that are very promising tools to find higher percentages of these learners would include things like the use of nonverbal ability tests, the use of performance-based assessment tasks that are very challenging but that are more domain-specific and that call on the student to actually show what they are able to do as opposed to merely performing on a paper and pencil test. So those are a couple of ways that we have really tried to find more students who represent these underrepresented categories. And I think that it is clearly a national agenda issue, but it's an issue in every state and locality that I know of as well. You might ask, as you did, I suppose, in terms of forming your question, why it is that we don't have too much evidence of equal representation at the present time from these groups in, classes for the gifted. And I would argue that, to some extent, classes for the gifted mirror the larger problem that we have in schools and that we have in society, and that is students in poverty, for example, do not have enriched home environments, do not have the opportunity for the kinds of intellectual nurturance that other students from more advantaged backgrounds have. And so it shouldn't surprise us that when they come to school, no matter how bright they may be in terms of their fluid intelligence, are not able to perform at the same level as students who've had some of those early advantages. So we have to do things, it seems to me, in the context of our policies and programs in gifted education to ensure that we're reaching those students early, that we're providing the kinds of nurturance that they need, and that we are continuing to scan the environment for new instrumentation that will help us do a better job of finding them. And then hopefully providing a good match of challenging curriculum that they can handle at all stages of development and a social network that will keep them involved in the program. One of the issues that is clearly a problem with some of our culturally diverse groups.
Now, I'm looking at Education Week, May 21st, 2008, and the title of the article is Ideas on Creative and Practical IQs Underlie New Test of Giftedness. Yale University is coming out with research and pilot testing assessments for identifying gifted and talented kids that tap into intellectual skills such as creativity and the ability to kind of navigate the everyday world. So that's exactly in line with what you're saying.
Right. You're alluding to Sternberg's model of competential intelligence.
Yes.
Which is, again, he's put his money where his mouth is. As the dean now of undergraduate studies at Tufts University, he's in the process of using these tests as part of the college admission process so that students who are admitted to Tufts, they will take the typical SAT, but they will have these value-added questions added that are performance-based in orientation that look at, creative ability and look at practical intelligence. So it's, again, a very interesting approach that's different from the status quo in terms of trying to find more of these underrepresented populations.
And, Joyce, I like your point that this begins early. And for these populations, finding them early is even more crucial. And I know in my own state, Maryland, we're using a program called Primary Talent Development that's for all kids. But that gives them these opportunities to show that they're practical, to show that they're creative.
even if they don't have all the ABCs in line like the other kids?
Well, I think that that's an extremely well-taken point, and unfortunately, we only have about another minute until the end of the show. So I wanted to go ahead and take this opportunity to thank both of you for accelerating our understanding about gifted education and the importance of talent development in our entire society. And I really am so inspired by the work and the passion that both of you have for this area and also for the students with special needs. I wanted to remind our listeners to be sure to tune in next week for our guest, who is Chancellor Michelle Rhee, the Chancellor of Education for the District of Columbia Public Schools, who will share with us the district's efforts in revamping a very troubled school system. Dr. Joyce Van Tassel-Baska and Dr. Jean Painter, thank you so very much for being with us today on Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education. Join us next week.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's edition of Teach Your Children Well, Hot Topics in Education. Join your hosts Rich Weinfeld and Michelle Davis again next Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, 12 noon Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Teach your children well, their father's health did slowly go by, and feed them on your dream, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you, you would cry. So just look at them and sigh.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.